Hi, I'm Danette Breitenbach, Managing Editor of Biz Community. Today I'm honoured to welcome Bronwyn Williams to Biz Trends TV. A futurist, economist, fintech specialist, Biz Trends analyst and media commentator, Bronwyn's trend IP is sought after by top 40 JSE listed and blue chip companies, government departments, businesses and institutions in Africa and around the world. She's also a columnist, author and co-author of several books, such as The Future Starts Now, Rescuing Our Republic, and most recently, Survive the AI Apocalypse. She has delivered hundreds of keynote addresses in her own right. And this year, she takes on the role, or took on the role, rather, as host of Wrapped Biz Trends TV. But today, we're turning the spotlight back on her. And we're interviewing one of South Africa's most valued trend minds. Welcome, Bronwyn.
Thank you.
This year, you conducted about 9, 10, I don't even know how many, but wonderful Biz Trends interviews. So were there any key trends or highlighted moments that stood out for you? And if so, why should businesses be paying attention to these?
Yeah, I think probably the most profound episodes were related to the topic that we covered in greatest detail with Gigi Alcock, looking at the informal economy, but many of our other guests also touched on this. And I think the big revelation, that if we haven't figured this out yet, we're all going to figure it out pretty quickly, is that the informal economy in South Africa, but in Africa in general too, needs the formal economy and our finance, aka debt, a whole lot less than we need them for growth in a degrowing, slow-growing, demi-recession kind of world that we're in at the moment.
And that kind of takes us quite nicely to my next question, because you're known for your Afro-optimism. Mm. And so what are you optimistic about for Africa now, and how does this informal economy fit in here?
Yeah, so I'm cautiously optimistic about Africa, but Africa has some real things that the rest of the world does not. It's got a growing population. It's got people, labor, talents. It's got real stuff. We've got minerals. We've got arable land. Africa's got the world's real wealth in our basically heart-shaped continent, and that we should be optimistic about, but cautiously optimistic, because that is basically like a treasure trove that's very attractive to the rest of the world and has been for a very long time. And Africa all too often ends up on the losing side of its own abundance due to external interests having a very big interest in the stuff that we've really got. And I think one of the biggest narratives we as a continent have to counter is the narrative that the rest of the world tells us that our real worth is actually not very expensive. And they encourage us to sell our labor, our land, our prime Cape Town seafront property to them at pennies on the dollar. So we need to step up and recognize our own value, because guess what? The rest of them do. And they're underplaying it because they know that by underselling us and telling us that, you know, people aren't worth what they used to be anymore, and a demographic dividend just doesn't cash out the same way it did for like China or India. These are all very deliberate narratives due to sort of get us to undervalue the real value that we have, which underpins the entire financialized global economy.
That's so interesting. And I think that it takes us to our next topic, which is AI, which we also can't ignore. I mean, you've recently collaborated on the book Survive the AI Apocalypse. So looking at Africa again, and AI as one of these fabulous new shiny toys, but one that's actually here to stay, I think. How does this impact us?
Well, it's going to impact us the same way that all these other waves of technology have impacted us, unless we kind of, again, come back to this idea of where the real value sits. And in the book that I wrote with Sharon Pierce, who was my co-author there, she's an expert in business transformation for very large organizations. What we've uncovered is that the world is unfair. I mean, I know, brand new insight. No one's ever thought of this before. But the point is that what technology does is it's very good at identifying the pools and pockets in the world where people are taking more than they are making. And then that, of course, becomes the attraction that attracts talent and technology to go and, you know, claw some of that back, right? So if you have the analogy of the fat, lazy pig over here, and then over there, you've got the lean and hungry young people with their little sticks and forks that want to come and get that pig. And you've also, of course, got the giant monsters, which in our little story here could be the nice big tech companies. You could just eat everyone up altogether, right? So it's a nice competitive state of nature kind of landscape that we're in that is very much survival of the fittest. And there's two kind of ways to play this, to play this out when it comes to technology. The one is to be a victim, and the other one is to figure out, forget about luck and start figuring out what you can do about things using your own agency to take luck out of the equation. So some people are going to see the wonders of artificial intelligence and try and bet on the hype cycle and invest in the stock markets or try and become the next Elon Musk, and good for them. But those are rock star odds. They're not, the odds are not in our favor for the rest of us. The other way we can try to sort of survive this shift is to double down on articulating, defending, and really being very clear that our counterparties understand our real value. So it's very similar to the points I was making about, like, the African continent has real value. Technology has the ability to accelerate the distribution of that value and enhance productivity. Sure, but underneath, the core underneath this is the real value we have. Real value is largely in the hands of human beings because we're the ones that buy stuff. AI can solve things for us and can go out and purchase as an agent on our behalf, but it doesn't have the desire underneath that. So coming back to those real core needs, unlike good old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, every marketer and business trends person understands that, is that all the other good stuff we only get to once we've figured out the real value at the bottom. And here, of course, when it comes to the African context, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to play this game. Are we going to sort of chase after those rock star odds and try and catch up with the giant monsters? Is it even possible at this point? Or have we invested in the education? Have we put the work in 20 years ago in order to compete on this playing field? Or are we going to have a different sort of place in this value chain? And are we able to figure out what that value is? And are we able to price that value fairly?
So based on that, what about the crypto and the digital currency space? What is happening there and how does that play out in Africa? Is it an advantage we could use?
Yeah, so we spoke to Heidi Patmore about this on the show, and yes, there's been a few bits of evolution since then. Like many of these buzzwords, we talk about AI or crypto or whatever it is, they go through those classic Gartner hype cycles. AI is now right at the top. I mean, the share prices are as high as they've ever been. Bitcoin, the NFT mania, all of the crypto craziness that saw us see young Sam Bankman-Fried sent to jail and all the rest of it at the end of that big bubble has sort of died down. But what's been happening really over the last 6 months is that all those technologies are now kind of converging in the sort of plateau of normalcy. In other words, being adopted by governments and by large financial institutions. A seminal Citibank paper came out this year talking about banks looking to tokenize all your assets. This is like the bank's equivalent of an NFT, only instead of tokenizing badly drawn clip art, they're now tokenizing your property deeds, right? Or your car, right? All your real stuff, but using exactly the same technologies. They're reaching like a maturity, but a maturity that's got a large base of incentive and money behind it. And at the same time, we see governments adopting really big technologies that are going to fundamentally change the way our financial plumbing works, the architecture of everything, in the form of stable coins, especially in the US, with the Genius Act that Donald Trump has signed in this year. Probably for entirely altruistic reasons. Nobody needs to look at his very own stablecoin he's set up with some of his friends and family. But stablecoins are going to allow the flow of international forex to be that much faster. And now that the Genius Act is in place, what it has done is semi-regulated the sector and underwritten those reserves, which means suddenly these are toys the real financial sector can play with, not just your libertarian fringes and your more risk-on kind of young consumers. And then, of course, you've got pretty much every other government in the world looking at those central bank digital currencies, which, of course, when you add together the tokenization of the private financial sector and the stable coinization of fiat money, suddenly you've got an entirely different digital rails along which our financial flows can run. And this can be seen in terms of its impact. It's very similar as to the impact of AI on our goods economy. So you've got the goods economy and you've got the money economy. AI has sort of automated and accelerated so much of what's going on in the production cycle and the goods side of the economy. These new rails are going to effectively grease up everything in the financial and monetary side of the economy. So think just like with AI, these tools could be in theory neutral, but they also accelerate underlying power dynamics. They accelerate speed. They amplify any distortions that we've got. So we need to understand that basically the world as we know it is going to be bigger, better, faster, smarter, and scarier all at the same time.
So speaking of scarier, I'm interested to know, where do African governments sit in terms of where this is playing out. Are we behind? Are there certain countries that are ahead? And what does that mean in the private sector? Because banks are moving ahead. Are governments keeping up with that? What are we seeing on the continent itself?
Yeah, well, these sorts of things, it looks like on paper, Africa is far behind because we're talking essentially about digital technologies, digital financialization of the finance and the monetary side of the economy, and digitization of the knowledge and the goods and service economy too. And of course, we've got some sort of major baseline things we have to get right, like not everyone on the continent is connected with a cell phone, even yet. You know, not everyone has access to data, not everyone has access to these points, and fundamentally, not everyone has access to digital identity points. And this is where the convergence of AI on the one side and sort of a digitization or blockchainization of the financial economy are converging. You require that digital identity to play, to automate, to put your agents into the market, which is where these two kind of loops together, right? Your financial agent can interact with the real economy and on it goes. But you still have to have that base level in place. You need to have electricity, you need to have data, you need to have devices to connect people to that electricity and that data, and you need to have the identity layer sorted out too, which makes people think that Africa is quite far behind. But in many ways, much like with our financial sector, not having infrastructure in place means you can integrate these things very quickly once you have political will to get going. And India is the great case in point, the most chaotic market that you can possibly imagine. And yet by simply putting a few kind of very large incentives and disincentives in place, they were able to digitize the economy very quickly, get people to sign up for the services, to integrate those on-ramps and off-ramps and get them onboarded into the digital infrastructure environment. And there are a lot of interests, public sector, private sector, NGOs, looking at Africa at how to produce that digitization layer, which, again, tying back to our informal economy, the incentives are huge. Governments, as well as the private sector, are looking to the unbanked and undigitized for the new source of growth in a very slow growth world. So once you've got political and financial will, you simply need an on-ramp and an off-ramp to get these systems started. And that on-ramp becomes congested really fast when that is connected to things like social grants, right? I mean, we've seen here how quickly we were able to digitize going away from debit orders towards like, or from cash handouts to debit orders and making people, even on the margins, digitize very, very quickly. So that space is going to be something that says, as they say, kind of slowly, then suddenly. And I don't think it'll be much far behind. I think it'll be largely harmonized and synchronized with what's going on with the rest of the world, because there's all sorts of incentives from tax evasions to gray listings to just looking for growth that is aligning incentives that pretty much no government is anti the progression to the digitized, automated economy we're moving into.
So in your opinion, do you think that we are going to leapfrog challenges? Because I think that's what you say.
Well, there's a bit of both. So there's this idea of dual use technologies, right? So this is a great concept we need to get our heads around. It's the same thing of saying that AI is in theory neutral. The blockchain is in theory neutral. It's what we do with it that matters. But these technologies are very, very powerful. The same technology that can enable digitized education and connectivity for your population can also enable surveillance and control for an authoritarian government, right? So this gives us choices, right? So I think the infrastructure is on a pretty clear trend path ahead. We know what's happening. We know how these technologies are converging. We understand what that enables. And that, on the one hand, can be very, very exciting. But in that other trouser of time, it can be very, very limiting. And that depends on the values layer and the political layer of our societies and economies. So the path ahead is quite divergent and quite dramatically so. And ultimately, when it comes to the future of Africa, our future is tied to the sorts of governments we elect and tolerate. And where we want to see some more sort of interesting challenges there is we can look at the Gen Z springs all over Africa, from like right next door to South Africa, all the way up the continent into the Middle East. We're seeing these youth-based movements pushing back against government overreach. And these generations and these generational protests are powered by the very same technologies that the governments are using to try and crack down on them, right? So it's this tightrope that we walk as we go forward into progress, that with every leap in progress, we increase our power level. We power up as a society. We can do more damage and we can do more good. And these are very new toys in very new hands. And we've got to just really be very careful about which patterns of behavior, which persons we are supporting and who we are allowing to effectively use these either weapons or wonders of the future with and for us or potentially against us.
So let's take it more to a more general level away from Africa, and let's just talk about your consultancy Flux Trends. You are known for identifying key trends every year. We all look out for them. So maybe you could give us a little bit of a heads up this year, mention one or two.
Well, I can't tell you too much, but I can tell you the theme that Dion and I are looking at is through the dark forest. So you can go do your internet research to figure out what these memes are. If you're an extremely online person, you will know what we are getting to. But essentially, it is speaking to the issues of artificial intelligence in particular and the effects on society, and also picking up on the narratives of how, for this year, for the first time, we now have more content generated by machines than humans, right? And like that's the sort of idea of a more sterile kind of information forest developing. And then what happens to the people walking through it, right? And how we navigate our way through this increasingly synthetic digital slash real world that we're all having to, navigate together.
It's got a very fairy tale,
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
dark side of the fairy tale
Yes, but fairy tales are
feel to
always
it.
balanced dark and light. And that's the real thing we've got to think about. These are magical technologies that allow us to have the superpowers previously available only to gods. There's a power to take an idea and materialize it, through a supply chain instantly. And this idea of this great power and then what we do with it, right? And much like fairy tales have the magic, but they also have the people. And usually the heroes are small children with wide eyes who notice and speak the truth, even amongst total obfuscation and many lies around them.
What about organizations and businesses? Maybe don't believe in fairy tales, unfortunately. What about them? How do they go about picking up these trends and actually making it part of the business? Is it quite difficult for organizations to sort of see the forest for the trees, to stay with
Sticking
your
with the metaphor.
analogy?
Absolutely. These technologies are very tempting, but they're also necessary. Businesses face this massive conundrum when it comes to these massive technologies with these enormous hype cycles. On the one hand, you can't afford to sit it out and get left behind, much like the Africa versus the rest of the world story. You have to cast your die. You have to be part of the future. You can't reject Excel when you are a bookkeeper. You have to move forward, with everyone else. But at the same time, understanding where to place your chips is a very high stakes game, which many people get wrong. I mean, the latest data shows how many AI transformation projects fail. Right. But the failure is not necessarily a catastrophic failure. That's what you got to do. Make sure that the bets that you're placing are all survivable. So maybe don't put all your chips in the same basket. Maybe you want to spread your bets, to use that analogy. But you have to bet something. You have to play. You have to move forward into this game. And in the book that Sharon and I wrote, we really double down on this idea of the solutionist mindset, which is understanding what you're doing and why before you go ahead and invest in things, right? Understanding that if at the very least, what you're doing when it comes to adopting new technologies, you are first starting with a problem for a real person that you're solving, rather than starting with an idea and then trying to retrofit that into an unwilling customer who wants no more AI shoved down their throat, right?
Very true. Culture has been one of the big trends, I think, this year, and everyone talks about it. But how do you see it contributing to what we're talking about, basically towards sustainable economic futures, or what you have termed future economies, economics?
The Futuronomics type things. Well,
There we go.
in terms of culture, right? Culture is a constantly being rewritten piece of code, right? It's something that we figure out through all the choices and all the interactions that we make. And what we've probably seen is a bit of a pivot too far into replacing culture and through connection with one-to-one human beings with culture through machines. Now that sort of loops back to the whole world of finance and technology and all those good things. It all comes down to trust, right? Like, human relationships are based on trust. And what we've tried to do is to replace the trust with code and rules. So whether that's a rating on a dating app, or whether that is a blockchain to verify that something is true or not, we've tried to sort of separate truth from you and I connecting with each other and deciding based on judgment whether we like each other, whether we want to work each other with each other, and whether we trust each other ultimately. So we've tried the whole sort of cutting humans out of the loop. We've tried now this year with our marvelous sort of MasterCard Agent Pay and our Perplexity AI browsers will go shopping for us and make all of our decisions for us. And we're going to probably try a bit more with that. But ultimately, what we're doing is we're sort of breaking the culture loops, right? Because we're letting something or someone else that is programmed for profit motives decide how those things play out for us. Decide even who we date and mate with based on, oh, the algorithm says this is the right person. My DNA test says I need to mate with someone like that. And we've sort of hollowed out a lot of that connection. It's made us quite lonely and sad. We don't need to talk too much about the loneliness and sadness data. But that sort of swinging roundabout will come around. But this is what happens. New technologies, new toys, we play with them. We might play with them too much. And then we have to come back and find out a way to do this in a more healthy basis. But again, from the economic side of this, our financial systems, as much as we've layered code on top of them, as much as we're adopting tokenization and stable coins and blockchain-based rails for our global economies, we still have these very real vulnerabilities about who controls those on-ramps and off-ramps, who captures that data, who validates that the code itself is a go, right? And where those sort of power lines lie quite literally. But also then it makes us, we trust these systems that don't necessarily trust us in exchange. And we might be trusting in numbers to just keep on going up when those numbers don't always come up, because those numbers that we see on stock markets are ultimately underpinned, like you were saying all along, by human needs and desires and by humans actually doing things. Even if all the thing they're doing is delegating that choice to a piece of code, there still has to be a person to do that, to receive the goods, to buy the service, right? So we're creating vulnerabilities for ourselves, and we've sort of fallen into the trap of believing that things that are digital equal things that are true. And we're going to have to unlearn that. And I love this point because just 40 years ago, we spent a lot of time teaching our parents and grandparents to trust in machines, to stop doing things themselves and to hand the work over, to use the Excel spreadsheet because it's faster, because it's better. And now we have to kind of undo that. So I talk about like the thesis, antithesis, synthesis of trying to figure out how to work with digitization. We went, let's trust it, don't trust it, there's mis- and disinformation, let's censor, let's do all the stuff that we're panicking with now, but we have to find a way to live with it. Yeah. And that involves merging common knowledge, which is a base for an operating system, a rail for finance and ideas to flow, still with your own personal judgment as to, do you want to believe this or not? Because digital doesn't equal true or real.
Wow. What about young South Africans? How is this pertinent to them? They've grown up differently. They perhaps didn't grow up when we were telling ourselves to trust the technology. They've grown up with the technology, so they're native to it. How does this play out for them?
Yeah, so in many ways, the millennial and Gen Z generations are the ones who have this whole transition the hardest, and younger generations have grown up as real natives within the system, immersed in the system, along with the new system, are much more fit to survive in it. And of course, they'll face future changes and challenges that we don't know about yet, they also have to learn to adapt with. But it becomes easier. Learning to integrate with digital and with that whole sort of connected economy was not natural for humans. You know, we've had to learn step by step by step. But at the same time, we've have these sort of crossover generations, the millennials on the one side who all are financial or monetary promises broke down for with the financialization of housing markets and, you know, all the debt crises that we're still all dealing with. And Generation Z is dealing with the fallout of the good side of the economy and the promises that we were told there and the rules that we sort of subterraneously believed in that our lives build on. This idea of go to school equals get a job equals get a stable life. Those promises don't play out. And that's why these two generations in particular, the millennials have lost out financially and Gen Z is losing out in the workplace. And it's creating this friction, right? But people have to figure out a new way of working, a new way of living. And again, the book that we wrote was all about that finding your personal value and separating your value from your price and from your job and from your job title and figuring out what is the value that you actually add into society. Ultimately, all this other stuff, the finance, the abstraction, the financialization, the fancy models, the AI, is all just either making things faster or slower or getting you closer or further away from real value translating from one person to another. So we've got to figure out how all that technology can help us come closer together and better justify value rather than unjustify it. So for young people, they've got to separate out those stories they were told about what success looks like and let go of a whole lot of ideas, because otherwise you're going to be setting yourself up for disappointment. And once you are able to focus on the actual value you bring, separate it from your job, from your salary, and walk forward, you are much better equipped in terms of agency and empowerment to survive in a very hyper-competitive world.
So finally, what is the one bold, Afro-optimistic prediction you're willing to make today for Africa in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I think it comes back to those trousers of time, which that's a metaphor from Terry Pratchett, said that the Discworld. But there's also the K-shaped economy, this idea of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. And understanding that where we are right now in this new wave of technology on the finance side and the good side, we get to choose which of those trousers we're going to crawl into and conversely sort of pull or additionally pull our future generations along with us into. But right now the variance is small when you're at the sort of the edge points of the K, but it becomes very, very large. The sort of two different versions of the future that Africa looks like, even in just 10 years time, depend very much on the choices that we're making now in terms of our finances, in which how we adopt new currencies and new identities, but also in terms of our goods, how we price them, how we sell them, how we bargain and negotiate with them across the rest of the world. So I think we've got lots to be optimistic about in that next sort of 10 to 15 years for Africa. And I think that those Gen Z protests that we see popping up, as much as many people will dismiss them, they have been able to replace entire parliaments and politicians, point to a fact that people aren't happy to just be dragged down the same trouser of time their parents were, and that perhaps we're going to be crawling out into a different direction to a way where those dual-use technologies can be used actually for the betterment of real people, not just for politicians and, you know, financial interests. So I think there's that divergence, and we really do have to choose, and the time to choose on that decision-making piece of cheese is getting less every day. You know, you want to make the decision when the cheese is still nice and fat, not when you're down to the skinny edges.
Like the fat pig. Thank you so much, Bronwyn. That's a wrap today of our episode of Biz Trends TV, The Headline Act. Huge thank you, Bronwyn, for sharing your insights and your foresights into how AI, fintech, culture, and African innovation are converging in this new era. We want to thank you also for being the host for the last year, and we look forward to welcoming you back into your chair in January. So look out for that. And if you found this episode inspiring or thought-provoking, please remember to like, subscribe, or follow us on Biz Community, Wrapped Biz Trends TV, The Real Network, on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. On behalf of me, Danette Redenbach, my guest, Bronwyn Williams, and the teams here at Biz Community and Wrapped Creative, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time as we continue to decode the trends shaping Africa's future.